This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. News reports yesterday indicate the standoff between Wisconsin Democratic state senators and the state's Republican governor, Scott Walker, may be nearing resolution. The governor's willing to back off on some of his attempts to limit collective bargaining in order to bring public sector workers and the Democratic state senators to the bargaining table. This comes as several opinion polls show that Americans generally favor the rights of public employee unions to bargain collectively. But does everybody really understand what those polls mean? What is collective bargaining? And what could the labor battles in the Midwest mean for unions in North Carolina? Joining me to talk about the state of collective bargaining are Mary B. McMillan, Secretary-Treasurer of the North Carolina State AFL-CIO, John Hood is President and Chairman of the John Locke Foundation, and Steve Allen is Associate Dean at the Jenkins Graduate School of Management at NC State University's Poole College of Management. Welcome all of you to the show. It's really good to have you here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Steve, let me start with you. You've been keeping an eye on the situations in Wisconsin and now Ohio, Indiana, and I guess Iowa, too. Are all these battles over the same essential rights?
Well, I think there are some nuances that are different on a state-by-state basis because you have to realize that for the states that allow collective bargaining, each one has its own unique set of rules. And so the rules of the game in Ohio may be somewhat different than the ones in Nevada or pick a random state. You know, I think, though, the common thread across all of these situations is you have, thanks to what happened in 2010, whether you're a big fan, whether you like the elephants or the donkeys, you now have a lot of elephants running the show that haven't really been in charge of both the governor's seat and the legislature. And so some questions that weren't being asked or considered up until now are being considered carefully. Well, so I think that's the big game changer.
So here, as you suggest, there are rules of the game. They're written into the law, but this is a political battle. And there are opinion polls that show, as we say, depending on how you ask the question, that people generally favor the right to collectively bargain. I mean, what do you make of these polls?
Well, I'm not a public opinion polling expert, and all I know is you can look at, I think the polls go they can go one way, they can go another. I think initially, public opinion, the teachers, the state employees in Wisconsin, when they occupied the state house, I think a lot of people were outraged at that, especially since those people were, on average, making more money than the average Wisconsin. I think since then, my reading of the media is the public opinion shifted a little bit, but I think, it's going to keep wavering one way or the other, depending on how this plays out.
John Hood, what do you make of those polls?
Well, they are all over the place. It depends on the question you're asking and the subject that you're really trying to test. I was looking recently at the polls from the Pew Research Center, Gallup, a number of other pollsters. If you use the word or the term collective bargaining rights, you get a lot of people concerned about any government taking them away. If you say collective bargaining and you leave out the word rights, you get a somewhat different answer, which suggests to me people aren't – there are lots of people who don't have strong opinions about this who aren't quite sure what we're talking about, and I think that's part of it. Also, when you ask which side do you side with, the governor or the Democrats in the state Senate who exited Wisconsin, again, it depends on the predicate of the question. If the question is in the context of balancing the budget, people still in Wisconsin seem to kind of favor Walker's position. But if you talk about collective bargaining per se – outside of the fiscal issue, then they side with the other side. So it does depend upon how the poll questions are asked. And I think a lot of this will be hard to evaluate now in real time. We'll have to figure it out later. We might look at other cases in recent years where there have been fights about these kinds of issues and then look years into the future. What happened? How did people ultimately decide that issue once they had time to really cogitate on it?
And it is a popular issue, as we say, a political issue. Mary B., how are these political fights in the Midwest playing out in a state like North Carolina?
Well, certainly it's an opportunity for us here in North Carolina to highlight the struggles of workers here who don't have collective bargaining rights. And I think it's important that people realize that this fight's really not about unions. It's about power. It's about management maintaining power in the workplace, and it's about corporate interests and the very wealthy maintaining political power. So certainly people beyond the labor movement need to pay attention to what's going on. I believe the polls. I think the majority of Americans do favor collective bargaining rights for workers in both the private and public sectors. And I think it's important for North Carolinians to realize the injustice of the law here that bans public sector collective bargaining. It says to our school bus drivers, we trust you enough to drive hundreds of kids to and from school every day, but we don't respect you enough to give you the same rights as a driver at Greyhound. It says to our police officers and firefighters that we expect you to risk your lives to protect us, but we don't respect you enough to give you the same rights as a security guard at the mall. There's something very wrong in this state when our school teachers, our sanitation workers, and our other public servants don't have the same right on paper that workers at Walmart and McDonald's have.
Steve Allen, tell us why this is a right at all. If we're buyers, if we're consumers, we don't form a group and negotiate with the seller of the product to come up with a price. So the economy doesn't like that sort of thing. But when it comes to labor, this country has recognized a need at some point in its history to create a special right for labor to get to the table and say, here's what we think our wages should be. Here's what we think our benefits should be when they're across from management. How's that right?
Well, I think that right has actually evolved over time. I think until the Wagner Act was passed in 1935, which was right in the middle of the Depression, there really weren't any rules of the game at all. And if a union wanted to be recognized in that time period, well, you had to somehow make it sufficiently miserable for the employer, usually through striking, for them to recognize you and bargain with you. And, you know, the clock, you know, the pendulum swung one way during the Depression, which I think was unions were able at that point to become a large-scale social movement. It was basically, we're not going to take it anymore. And, you know, very desperate times. In fact, I sometimes wonder if we're getting close enough that something like that might not come back even in the private sector here. So, you know, I think the right is, you know, want to be careful. I always say it's not in the Constitution necessarily, but I think if you look at most globally at the countries that are at the standard of living and standard of liberty that we have in the United States, collective bargaining, I believe, is generally accepted as a right across all those countries.
Should it be, John Hood? Should it be a right?
Well, again, it depends on what you mean. If the idea in a free society is that there would be some government policy or law or regulation that precludes people from getting together voluntarily, trying to deny their services to a potential employer unless the employer offers them appropriate pay and wages, that or pay and benefits, that should always be legal. The question here is, in the public sector context, you're not negotiating with a private employer that's competing with other employers. You're negotiating with the government, and the unions can be involved in selecting the people with whom you're negotiating. But more importantly than that really is, should we have a situation where people have to belong to a union in order to get a job in a public sector workplace? Do you have the right to deny your dues if you don't agree with what the union is doing politically or otherwise? I think actually those issues, if you addressed those issues, closed shop and other kinds of intrusions on workers who may not want to participate, then the collective bargaining argument will become an easier sale in the public sector. Right now, I don't think in North Carolina it will happen at all. I mean, there's just no large constituency for it.
Mary B., is that true? And is the devil in the details? It's how you write the collective bargaining rules that would make all the difference?
Well, first, back on the issue of whether it's a right. I mean, without question, the right to collectively bargain is a basic human right. The Universal Declaration of Rights that the United States signed on to in 1948 recognizes workers' right to association and to bargain as a basic human right. The International Labor Organizations of the United Nations says that this is part of international labor law, and in 2007 called on the United States to establish a framework for collective bargaining and specifically said that North Carolina should repeal its ban on public sector collective bargaining. This is a basic civil right. And here in North Carolina, I mean, what we are trying to do, the bill that we have introduced in past legislative sessions, was just a minor step. We were just simply asking to take the law off the books so that our public workers have the same rights that private sector workers in this country have had since 1935. I think that when the majority of people out there understand that and hear that, they support it. And I believe that we will change the law in North Carolina.
What about John's distinction that when you're bargaining with the state, you're bargaining with a kind of monopoly power? They're not in competition with anybody else, and it's a different kind of bargaining than if you were in the private sector.
I mean, I don't buy that argument, and I don't buy into the argument that because, you know, unions make political contributions, that that should have any impact on this. I mean, look at corporations and the amount of contributions they make to elected officials who then sit in regulatory capacities and pass laws that affect their interests. I mean, there is no reason that workers in the public sector shouldn't have the same right as workers in the private sector.
On the State of Things today, we're talking about collective bargaining in the public sector. My guests are Mary B. McMillan, Secretary-Treasurer of North Carolina State of AFL-CIO, John Hoods, President and Chairman of the John Locke Foundation, Steve Allen is Associate Dean at the Jenkins Graduate School of Management at NC State, and we're going to take your phone calls and your emails when we return, 877-962-9862, SOT@WUNC.org. Should public workers be able to collectively bargain? We're talking about that on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. Broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, talking today about unions and collective bargaining, particularly in the public sector. My guests are Mary B. McMillan, Secretary-Treasurer of North Carolina's AFL-CIO, John Hoods, President and Chairman of the John Locke Foundation, Steve Allen is Associate Dean at the Jenkins Graduate School of Management at NC State University's Poole College of Management. Right now, I want to welcome Robert Korstad. He is the Kevin D. Gorder Professor of Public Policy and History at Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy. I'm going to take your phone calls and emails, 877-962-9862, SOT@WUNC.org. Should public workers have the right to organize and collectively bargain? Bob Korstad, let's talk a little bit about the history of labor in this state. North Carolinians have much different attitudes about labor than Midwesterners do. Why is that?
Well, I think that North Carolina hasn't had a kind of rich history of unionization. It doesn't mean that workers in a variety of industries in the public sector and the private sector haven't tried to unionize over the years. I think there have been a number of factors that have limited that unionization. The kind of industry that we've had was built on kind of low-wage relatively unskilled work, which is, people are fairly easily replaceable, so it made unionization very difficult. Race relations, employers played black and white workers off against each other repeatedly, threatening, to hire one if the other tried to organize. I think probably as important is that because of disfranchisement and the kind of relatively low rate of political participation by working class people, the state of North Carolina has been very anti-union and have been very pro-employer pretty much throughout its history, and has intervened in a number of places to limit workers' rights and to use the power of the state. And so, we don't have a long tradition of unions in this state. So I think most people, haven't had contact. They haven't understood the benefits and stuff. So I think that makes maybe attitudes a little bit different.
Mary B., what's it like organizing in this state?
I mean, it is difficult because there is this a legacy and this culture that tends to be against unions. And I think that there's a lot of stereotypes and myths out there. And also, it's difficult to organize because union busting has become an industry, and corporations, have their consultants and their lawyers, and they hold captive audience meetings, and they only get a slap on the wrist if they violate workers' rights and illegally fire workers during union organizing campaigns. So it's definitely an uphill battle for workers to organize, whether it's in the private or public sector. And I'd say that's the case here in North Carolina, and we have this special history, but that's also the case around the country.
John Hood, you have made the point that when it comes to the public sector anyway, it's not as though public workers don't negotiate. They have means, they have associations, and they are part of the political discussion.
I think it would come as a surprise to most people who are engaged in political affairs or public policy in North Carolina to be told that the people who work in state agencies and in school districts so are not represented. They're very actively represented and have been so for decades. Probably one of the most powerful organizations in state politics is the North Carolina Association of Educators, which is the affiliate of the National Teachers Union, the NEA. They do not have formal collective bargaining procedures, as you might find in other states, but in effect, they spend much of their time bargaining on behalf of their collective membership with the people who employ them, and bargaining over pay, over how the professionals and the workers will be evaluated on the working conditions and on their benefits, health care, pension, and other benefits. So I think that the notion that collective bargaining doesn't exist, I think, is somewhat depending on how you define it. But we, of course, you've got to stipulate that in North Carolina you don't have the formal contracting process that you have in Wisconsin.
Well, Steve Allen, what difference does that make then, the idea that you're formally represented by a union or you have an association that does do some lobbying?
Well, I think the biggest difference really is at the workplace level, where if you have, say, some safety or working condition issues, or you have some sort of grievance issue, you know, in some branches of the state government and the school system, there are grievance procedures. Other cases, it's kind of, exit or voice, to use the term of Al Hirschman in a book he wrote many years ago. You know, and that's the way the labor market works. If you don't like a job, you can always leave it. But unions do provide a way of providing a framework for negotiation and discussion that isn't available in non-union workplaces.
And there are legal protections for union members so that if you got to the point where management didn't like what you were saying or how you were negotiating, a union member has more protection against being fired, for instance, isn't that true, than if you were a non-union association member?
Well, and plus if you have a contract, which is the importance of collectively bargaining, I mean, it spells out, you know, reasons for dismissal. And as Steve Allen said, there's a grievance procedure so that workers can go and have those grievances addressed. I mean, I think it's important to realize that collective bargaining is not just good for workers. I mean, it's also good for government and citizens. If you look at states that have collective bargaining, they have a much less turnover in their workforces. That means that state governments have less recruitment and training costs. I haven't seen the latest figures, but in 2007, the state of North Carolina spent over $500 million in recruitment and training costs. That's money in this budget crisis that could be spent on vital public services. And when you have less turnover, it means you have more experienced employees delivering services to citizens. So there are other advantages of collective bargaining as well.
877-962-9862 is the number to call. Isaac is on the line from Raleigh. Hello, Isaac.
Hello. How are you today, Frank?
Good. Good.
Thank you for the show. It's a very interesting topic. I just recently moved last year from Atlanta, and I'm surprised to know that North Carolina doesn't have collective bargaining. But to be brief, I commend maybe her comments and all of your guests for being here today, but she's dead on, and this is a right, which is a civil right, in my opinion, is a human right, and it's one that's well-deserved, and North Carolina should look at the rest of the country, and there's a reason why we're way in the minority on this, on the wrong side of this issue. To answer your question, public workers should have that right in this state.
Isaac, thank you very much for the call. John Hood, there is this question, though, of the responsibility of the state to handle our public officials. You know, it was interesting because Governor Scott Walker was asked point blank, look, if you take away the right to collectively bargain, aren't you giving the government the upper hand in the negotiations? And he said, yeah.
You ultimately allow local and state government to determine what the pension and health care benefits are in the future. Absolutely. That's what local governments have been asking for years. They don't have that right now. I didn't have that when I was the county executive. That's why time and time again, I'd come back to the unions in Milwaukee County and ask for simple changes in terms of pension or health care contributions. I even asked for a while for a 35-hour work week. Their response to me was, we don't want it. You can go do something else. Go lay off 400 or 500 employees. We don't care.
Now, there's a guy looking at a $3 billion budget deficit, and he's saying, hey, I asked you guys to give me something back, and you didn't. And he feels that what he should have is the right to simply impose the agreement. I mean, is that right?
Well, remember that when Walker is talking about being a county executive, essentially like a mayor of a county in Wisconsin or other officials at the state and local level, these are people who are elected in political processes in which lots of people participate, taxpayers, people who work for the state or local government, vendors of those. So the political process that leads to a legislature or a county commission or something itself includes all these different voices. His argument is that if we have problems in flexibility to adjust pension benefits, other kinds of things, even the evaluation of employees. If we don't have the flexibility to do that because of union contracts, it prevents us from carrying out our public mission. It's not several individuals who have a lordship who want to impose their will on everybody else. It's should the elected representatives at a local or state level be allowed to get their way if they win the election. That's essentially what it's about. And this is one reason why the rules for federal government workers are different. I think the people have listened more in Washington than they have in some of these state capitals.
Steve Allen, how does that work? Do those arguments apply in the marketplace when you're looking at economics? Do things change when you're talking about public employees who, after all, are now working for somebody who was elected by a populace who may or may not have said in that vote, do away with collective bargaining?
Well, it's kind of interesting that the budget crisis is being used as a premise for this whole discussion, because if you look at, say, 30 years of evidence on compensation in the public sector, the evidence is overwhelming that if you control for the what we call the human capital of the workers, their experience, their education, that public sector workers probably are underpaid compared to the private sector by an order of, 5-10%. Now, that's on wages and salaries. Flip that to benefits and they get overpaid compared to the private sector. Right now, those forces are probably close to in balance. I think the big question that I think if I were governor of Wisconsin, I'd be worried about is the next 10, 20 years on the benefit side. There's a benefit, you know, all the baby boomers my age in bracket, we're going to be cashing out. And Wisconsin hasn't put enough money in the kitty to handle that in the past. That's not Governor Walker's problem. He inherited it.
877-962-9862. Let's go to Paul in Pinehurst. Hello, Paul.
Hey, thanks for your story today. I just want to comment. I think the AFL-CIO lady brings up the point that, at least in the government context, you need to have unions to speak truth to power. You might be able to make that argument in the corporate context, but that's not really true in the government context. You know, apparently I'm the power. I'm the taxpayer that has to pay all these salaries and these exorbitant benefits, and I can't do anything to limit it. It's really unfair. And if you think about it, can you name an organization, especially in the private sector, that runs efficiently with a union? I can only think of one, which would be UPS. Other than that, unions only bring inefficiencies and extra costs that shouldn't be there.
All right. Paul, thank you very much. Mary B.?
There are plenty of unionized companies that are doing quite well. And this argument that union members, whether they're in the private or public sector, are going to bankrupt their employer is insane. I mean, workers want a job. They're not going to bargain their way out of a job. And I think that's one point. The other point is we are not talking about public workers who are overpaid and on a gravy train. We're talking about folks making $40,000 or $50,000 a year. And it's amazing to me that people are fixated with them and scapegoating those workers when we have the CEOs who created this financial crisis in the first place making millions. And if we're so concerned about our budget deficit, why are we giving corporations tax breaks while we're at the same time asking workers to sacrifice? This is not about unions. This is not about workers. This is about power. This is about corporate interests continuing to tip the balance of power in their favor.
Bob Korstad, historically in this state, was there a time when, because we know, you know, labor unions have never been particularly strong. You've written about that. Mm-hmm. Was there a time when they were more popular? What was happening when there was an effort, a nearly successful effort to organize?
Well, I think the 1940s during the World War II and the aftermath, and then for a time in the 1950s, unions were stronger in North Carolina than they have been recently. And I think to some extent it gets back to the issues that were really of primary importance to people that weren't – I mean, they were interested in wages and benefits, but it was all around questions of respect and dignity. You know, if you go back and look at – Dr. King's last moments. He's in Memphis working with sanitation workers. Well, if you look at the photographs from that period, you know, what are the signs that every one of those sanitation workers are carrying? It's not, you know, I want more money or I want more time off to go to the bathroom. It's, you know, their placards all read, "I am a man." You know, it's all about, you know, being treated with respect, having some kind of control over your workplace, having some kind of recourse when you're treated unfairly, having some kind of collective power. After all, businesses, corporations, or government agencies, they're all their collective power. You know, if you're working in a factory, you've got a whole chain of command. If you're just one person trying to combat that collective power, you're going to get nowhere. And I think that so that unions have traditionally tried to really just balance the power in the workplace. And I think that's true whether you're working in a government, in a university, in a textile mill, or on a farm.
Well, what about that, John Hood? To achieve the kind of symmetry that markets require to work efficiently, workers need to be organized against the organized capital. They can hire legal departments and public relations departments that, as an individual worker, I can't do.
Well, if people were pursuing that goal through voluntary means, I wouldn't have any problem with it, and it has been useful in some situations to do that. I think that a lot of times we misrepresent or fail to recognize the extent to which state power is used on behalf of unions to compel membership in some places, or to compel payment of dues even if you're not a member, or to otherwise get advantages that would not be existent in a voluntary system. Now, we're moving into an economy where I think that there's obviously going to be a role for professional associations of various sorts to help people get training, find job opportunities, get legal assistance if they have a problem. And I think those kinds of organizations can thrive without the kind of 1930s era baggage that doesn't have a lot of relevance today.
So some rules have to change, but would those associations have to have some of the legal protections that unions now have, including enforcement of their contract and all of those, and protection against being fired for organizing workers in negotiating with the labor?
Well, I think that if you have a contract and the contract is being violated, you should always have a recourse to enforce the contract. But that's different from saying workers should be allowed to do whatever they want, deny their services in the form of striking or whatever, and not be replaced. I don't understand why that has ever been considered a right. That should always be. It's the employer is hiring people to do a job. If the people don't want to do the job, then the employer has every right to hire somebody else to do the job.
Mary B., how about that? We'll start with replacement, but also talk about mandatory dues and having management collect the dues for the union. Are those important?
I mean, this whole kind of argument that, you know, unions intimidate workers and they coerce workers, I mean, how do we do that? Membership cards. I mean, the boss controls the paycheck and the pink slip. Union organizers are in there with membership cards and informational leaflets. It's clear who has power, and that's why it's so important that workers have the ability to join together. And the double standard in this country, it's staggering. You know, CEOs join together as the Chamber of Commerce. CEOs wouldn't work a day without a contract, but they don't want workers to have that right. I mean, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce spends $50 million a year trying to fight unionization efforts. The double standard's unacceptable, and I think what you're seeing in Wisconsin and around the country is that people are rising up and saying, we American workers are tired of being second-class citizens.
Steve Allen?
Well, I think, you know, there is one other protection that you have, and that's to have a skill set or a set of contacts that makes you extremely valuable to the employer. And so, if you look at the broad class of jobs, I think more and more that's becoming very difficult, and to predict what occupations you can get into that will give you that leverage is, we had New York Times running a story about lawyers now being displaced by text crawling computer algorithms. So I felt sorry for lawyers.
There's an article we should all read, I suppose, just as a kind of an exercise in humility for all of us. On the state of things, we're going to take more of your phone calls and continue our conversation about collective bargaining, particularly in the public sector. We want to hear from you, 877-962-9862. should there be should collective bargaining be allowed? Should it be prohibited in the public sector? Give us a call, 877-962-9862, SOT@WUNC.org. If you want to send us an email and join our guests today, John Hood, Mary B. McMillan, Steve Allen, and Bob Korstad. Coming up after a short break, what changes in collective bargaining rights might mean for future elections and whether or not the public's view is changing. 877-962-9862. Give us a call. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking about the state of collective bargaining and unions in North Carolina. My guests are Mary B. McMillan, Secretary-Treasurer of North Carolina's AFL-CIO, John Hood's President and Chairman of the John Locke Foundation, Steve Allen, Associate Dean at the Jenkins Graduate School of Management at NC State, Robert Korstad, Kevin D. Gorter, Professor of Public Policy and History at Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy. You can be on the program as well at 877-962-9862. Bob Korstad, there was some talk earlier about unions being inefficient. Not all companies have them, and they're very efficient. But unions traditionally have had an impact on even non-union shop. I think organizing at Reynolds mm-hmm. is probably a pretty good example of that. If you can give us a kind of a very brief sketch of how the threat of unions or the possibility of unions change their management style.
Well, I think, yeah, in North Carolina in particular, and R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company is a good example. After they were successfully organized in the mid-1940s, the company really basically adopted most of the work rules, the seniority provisions, a kind of informal grievance procedure, because they understood it made good sense. It regulated the workplace. It was a chaotic situation then there in many ways. And they also, not wanting to have to deal and address unions, kept their wages a little higher, benefits a little higher than the organized plants in Durham. And, you know, there's a way in which unionization puts pressure on other firms to behave better, to pay better. And I think that's one of the things we're seeing in this country right now is with the loss of unions in the private sector is that that kind of pressure on corporations has been lost. And it's one of the reasons for both the runaway shops and also just the loss of bargaining rights for people.
And Steve Allen, does that have a generalized effect across the economy? The mere presence of unions somewhere has an effect on businesses and managers everywhere.
Yeah, I think economic and management research tends to show there's really two types of effects that are relevant for this discussion. One is with a union, you do have to treat workers with respect, but you also have to make some management adjustments. And in fact, often when unions organize a plant, back when unions were organized plants with some regularity, one of the first reactions would be they'd get rid of the existing bunch of managers. And maybe it was how do those clowns let a union get in here to begin with? But often you ended up with better management practices across the board after a plant became unionized. So I think that can spill over to other companies that aren't unionized. The other part, though, concerns really the size of the middle class. And some of the economic research that has come is that, one factor, I'm not saying it's the dominant, but it's part of the story, is that one reason there seems to be a little bit of hollowing out in the middle of the wage distribution is they're just those union jobs that people's parents had, just they aren't there anymore.
How about that, John?
Well, I agree that there are some jobs that people used to make good money at who had high school educations or less. They also happen to be unionized. But I think that the larger story there, because if you look at both places where they were unionized, places where they weren't, this was more change of sectoral nature. In other words, manufacturing that America had kind of an artificial advantage in after World War II, when the industrial base of much of the rest of the industrialized world was destroyed. We had this artificial advantage for about 20 years, but eventually Europe and Japan were able to rebuild. They became more competitive, more competitive, more competitive. And I think international competition in manufacturing is a bigger story there than the presence or lack of unions.
But there has been since 1980, and that was well after we lost that advantage, a decoupling of productivity from wages. And so while productivity continued to rise, wages went flat and even declined a little bit. That would suggest that there's a real widening of the gap.
Well, there are a variety of factors, as Steve was saying, that go into this. But importantly, it's you can't look at wages. What also happens in the late 70s, early 80s is that increasing amounts of our compensation are being received in the form of non-wage benefits. So when you add in the value of non-wage benefits to the story, the story is not nearly as dire for workers. Now, that may not be their preference. Perhaps they would prefer to have wages rather than non-wage benefits. And I agree with that we have artificial tax and other subsidies that encourage people to take non-wage benefits. And that's a real problem. But I don't think it's a problem related to unions.
Mary B.
There's a clear correlation between the well-being of unions and the well-being of the middle class in this country. If you look back in history, when unions were strong, income inequality was much less, the middle class expanded, and wages rose as workers' productivity increased. As corporate interests began their war against unions, as our membership declined, you have seen income inequality rise to unprecedented levels. The middle class has shrunk, and as you mentioned, wages are not keeping pace with our productivity. This is an important battle, as I said, not just for unions, but anyone who cares about the survival of the middle class in this country should be concerned with what's going on in Wisconsin and around the country. So at some point, politicians are going to have to realize that workers matter. We are the ones who produce the goods and services our society depends on. We are the consumers who shop at businesses. We are the taxpayers who provide revenue for government. And when you take away our buying power, like decades of stagnating wages and all these job losses have done, the whole economy suffers just like it did in this recession. So I keep wondering, you know, how low are we going to go in this global race to the bottom? Paying workers less and less and taking away our rights is absolutely not how we rebuild the economy.
877-962-9862. Dave is on the line from Roxborough. Hi, Dave.
Hey, Frank. How are you?
Good.
Look, I appreciate the discussion. It's really nice to hear y'all talking about collective bargaining in depth. I just called to just say that I'm an IBEW member. That's the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. I work with a telecommunications company in Durham for 28 years. I was involved in some of our contract negotiations over the years and a number of things in the workplace. And one of the things that folks touch on is the union's grievance process and collective bargaining aspects as it relates to resolving company problems. And one of your guests just touched on that a minute ago. And I just wanted to kind of reiterate, you know, that we have an opportunity whenever we get together with the company and we address issues, not only our issues in the workplace, but problems that we have trying to provide service to customers. And where that applies, of course, to the public sector is, I've heard this several times, where the teachers are continually making the point that they have the ability to go advocate for smaller class size, for different curriculum, whatever the issue is. That's their opportunity. What makes it so important is that you have a contract that you can fall back on your grievance procedure if you need to. You don't have to worry as much about a higher-up management person retaliating against you, you know what I'm saying, causing you problems, possibly firing you, because you've got a different opinion about how they're doing things. At the end of the day, you know, as union members, we have a vested interest in our company succeeding and being the best that they can be. And we work to that end. We expect our management people to be competent and to make good decisions to help us facilitate that. I can tell you, as a member of a Fortune 100 company, that's not always the case, and that won't come as a surprise to a lot of people. But through our contract, with our grievance procedure, and our ability to stand up to these folks and say, look, what you're doing is wrong. The customer suffers. We're suffering. We need to work this out.
All right, Dave. Well, making a good point. I want to get a response to it. Thank you for calling. John Hood, a worker with some protections, can be a better employee because he can be more honest.
I'm sure that's true. And I'm sure that there are some cases in the public sector where you might find abusive work practices. It's easy to fire people who disagree. But I'll tell you that in the major chunks of state government, like the public school and large amounts of state agencies, it is very difficult to fire employees. There are elaborate regulations built into the law and into the rules that govern hiring and retention and promotion and pay and benefits, and to suggest, well, we have to have formal collective bargaining so we can finally introduce these protections on behalf of teachers and state employees sounds odd to me. My father, both of my parents were members of the teacher union, by the way. My father was a school principal, and he found it extremely difficult to fire. He didn't want to fire teachers who you know, disagreed with him. He couldn't fire teachers who were obviously incompetent. It took many, 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 many years. I don't think our problem is excessive firing.
Mary Beat, already enough protections? We don't need unions.
Absolutely not enough protections. I mean, you know, there's certainly going to be these isolated cases that people can point to of folks that should have been fired and couldn't be fired. But go out there and talk to sanitation workers, talk to school bus drivers about issues that they're facing on the job. They absolutely need a voice. They have concerns. I mean, look at the Raleigh sanitation workers. They had an issue getting, you know, adequate pay, and then they had to take action for that to happen. There are many issues, a lot of them not even about wages. Folks just wanting, you know, to be able to go to the bathroom and to take breaks. I mean, we've seen that with housekeepers on UNC campuses being told they can't sit down. Workers in this state, public sector workers, need to have the same rights as a worker at Walmart. How in the world can we say to our firefighters, we expect you to risk your lives to protect us, but we're not going to give them this basic right? It is shameful.
Bob Korstad, we said earlier, I think Mary B. was talking about earlier, the fact that, you know, union workers in general, are consumers. And so if you're not paying them, then they're not buying stuff. And if they're not buying stuff, the company that hired them could ultimately be hurt. This has been a problem for owners for a long time. And yet, wages have pretty much stayed steady, while productivity and profits certainly have risen. How is that possible? How did that happen that you could not increase wages and yet increase business and sales?
Well, I think one of the problems here is we're in a new kind of global context. And I was reading something the other day in which someone was arguing that actually corporations in the United States now are not nearly as concerned with consumer spending as they were in the 1920s and 1930s. So we're not going to see, you know, another Henry Ford and $5 a day wage in order to keep up consumption. In fact, you know, they're looking at other parts of the world and in China and India and the Middle East as the, you know, as the object of their sales. And so there are a lot more potential customers in China. There are a lot more potential customers in India. They've already moved, you know, so much of the production process out of the United States. And the argument is that, you know, corporations, they're operating on this international basis now. And they don't care about American consumers and American workers. And I think you could look at that in North Carolina. I mean, we had, you know, 20, 30 years ago, we had a vibrant economy. We had workers that were productive, and we had the modern technologies, and we don't have a textile industry anymore. We don't have a tobacco industry. We don't have a furniture industry. We don't have an apparel industry. We don't have a hosiery industry. And, you know, these people you know, lost our interest and have moved on. And I think one of the frightening things in the United States is that, you know, we're going to be this kind of middle class that we've had is going to be lost.
Steve Allen, those are the rules of a market economy, right? If my dollar can earn more in Vietnam, then there it goes and the job with it. And that means we might be spending a little less in your state, but you'll all make an adjustment because prices will be better for you in the long run. I mean, isn't that's how things should work, isn't it?
Well, that's kind of the grim side of things. I think you really need to be focusing also on how you create wealth and opportunity down the road. And I think to some extent, you know, that say the science, technology training that we're doing, going back even to the K-12 levels, but certainly you look at NC State, 3/4 of the PhDs we give are foreign nationals.
Is that right? 3/4 of the PhDs?
Oh, it's a huge percentage in scientific technical disciplines. Mm-hmm. And so there's something for the market economy to work the way it should. we should be creating new exciting opportunities for the future to replace the textiles, the hosiery jobs. We're doing that, I think, to some extent in North Carolina. Certainly, there's a lot of bioscience-related activity in this region that wasn't here 10 years ago. But it's not, I don't think, really scaled yet at the level to create new opportunities at a fast enough rate to replace some of the ones that are getting atrophied. So, yeah, we're going to lose low-tech jobs to, you know, pick your country, Vietnam, Malaysia, well, Brazil. But we've got to create new ones.
Does collective bargaining figure into that?
I don't really see how collective bargaining figures into creating new markets, new technologies, new opportunities. I think you need lots of things in place to make those things work.
Mary B.?
I think that workers' right to collectively bargain definitely figures into keeping the middle class alive and to keeping the buying power of consumers at a level that we can maintain the economy. But I do think Steve makes a good point that really our elected officials need to be focused on job creation. That's what people need the most right now. And in fact, I think that, you know, voters in November, they went to the polls and they voted for jobs. And instead, they're getting an attack on workers. And I think already you're seeing voters' remorse. I mean, there was this poll that showed that if the election for the Wisconsin governor were held right now, Governor Walker would lose by the same percentage he won in November. So I think that the voters really want to see our elected officials take up job creation and not cutting corporate taxes and doing everything that they can for the corporate interests that put them in office.
Do you think there are these protests? We did see some movement on the part of the Wisconsin governor, perhaps in response to that poll, a little more openness to collective bargaining. Are we seeing a shift in the landscape? Are we seeing a more pro-union environment as a result of this fight in the Midwest, Bob Quist?
I think so. I think there are a lot of people who haven't had experiences of union directly themselves but are the beneficiaries, whether through their parents or grandparents, are starting to get a better appreciation and understanding of how important that has been to the creation of their own opportunity. So, and I think that there's a lot of mobilizing, a lot of people around the young people in particular around the country. They're looking at things in Egypt and Libya and seeing these kinds of freedom movements. And there is a kind of hope and expectation that we're going to be involved in creating the kind of society that we want to have. Because I think, you know, at the end, this is all about – it's all about values. It's all about the kind of world we want to live in. Do we want to live in a world in which we've got, you know, 1% of the population consuming some huge amount of our resources? Or do we want a more democratic, a more egalitarian society in which – you know, everybody has enough to eat in a decent place to live.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. Robert Korstad, Kevin D. Gorder, Professor of Public Policy at Duke, Steve Allen, Associate Dean at the Jenkins Graduate School at NC State, John Hood, President and Chairman of the John Locke Foundation, Mary B. McMillan is the Secretary Treasurer of the State AFL-CIO. Thank all of you for listening and for calling in. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.